Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is our producer, Chris Cervello, who joins us periodically for a week in review. He is also one of the co-founders of the PR firm Provision Advisors. Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
Certainly an interesting week from, finally the wait is over and Joe Biden has announced his running mate, Kamala Harris. I think coming to where I think people thought he was going to end up, which I think is the interesting thing about Joe Biden, deliberative. I think it was a New York Times story that compared it to sort of buying a minivan, right? You want it to be reliable. You want it to be predictable. And that's certainly, I think some progressives are disappointed with that. But let's just take a recap of the week. We started with Al Schaefer. Al's a terrific public servant, and it was interesting. It was interesting to get his take on the fact that we're kind of early in the coronavirus and that this is going to be much more of a marathon than a sprint in terms of how to approach it and impacts on the defense industrial base. He was very candid that $11 billion would be important. Otherwise, the department would have to make some choices. And talked about, I think, you know, it has the administration, for all the criticism it's gotten elsewhere, has had a pretty thoughtful senior acquisition team that has gelled and is working together better, certainly now that the new organization has had a little bit of miles under its belt. What were some of the key takeaways from your standpoint as we sort of ricochet through what we've covered for the week and then talk a little bit about next week?
You kind of hit it with Al Schaefer. I was most struck by how candid and willing to talk about the lessons learned that he and his team have begun to put together on the pandemic, things that they maybe wish that they knew at the beginning, things that they've learned, and the fact that, as you said, there's still a lot to do with regards to the Defense Production Act and support that the Defense Department will have to lead, whether it's for companies or whether it's for states or whether it's for other parts of the federal government. So he really kind of peeled back the curtain, if you will, so that folks could get a sense as to the type of work that's being done in support of the pandemic. I think maybe because of the coverage till now, a lot of people thought that maybe some of that work was done or that it had moved on to a second phase. But you really walk away from his explanation, recognizing one, how hard he and his team are working, and two, like you said, how much more there is to do.
He did talk a little bit about the Defense Production Act, that sort of the Pentagon oversees it in his office, and Ellen Lord, I think, she is the senior DOD lead for it. But also sort of made clear, because the program has come under some criticism, what they're doing through their deliberative process, but obviously other arms of the government, whether it was the Kodak decision or others, you know, certainly HHS, Health and Human Services are involved. The White House is also involved. So they're sort of the executor of those decisions. I thought that was kind of a good clarification for him to make.
No, it was important for him to make because, I mean, one, I give him and his team a lot of credit for not taking that Kodak question, off the table. He answered it from his perspective, and that was the fact that whether it was this decision or any other decision, as you said, I mean, they're responsible for executing, and all of these decisions go through the normal legal review, and once a decision is made, it's over to him and his team to execute. And so I hope anyone that is a scholar of these types of processes or decisions will go back and listen to that carefully. And I certainly hope anybody that is either going to be part of the Trump administration part two or the Biden administration, whichever way it goes, listens to this interview, because he shared a lot about the types of challenges that they're working through, one of which is, as you said, that Kodak decision.
And, you know, and he made it very, very clear that everything DOD does, it does through legal counsel,
right.
which is what you would expect from somebody who's devoted his entire life to national security. Let's talk a little bit about the interview with General Gregson, retired Marine Corps three-star who's at the Center for National Interest now, and also Misha Auslan, Dr. Auslan from Stanford's Hoover Institution, two very, very serious minds on Asia policy. And I thought that at a time when the entire world's attention has sort of descended on Hong Kong, that they were so realpolitik about it, that there's nothing we can do for Hong Kong, and that our focus now has got to be on Taiwan. Did you find that as depressing as I did?
I thought of the, I think it's Alien, right? Where Bill Paxton says, game over, you know, game over, man. I mean, that's kind of what you think of when they talk about the United States' ability to influence what's going on in Hong Kong. I have never been to Hong Kong, but I know many people that are Westpac sailors or people that are involved in national security that have been there, and they speak very highly, both in terms of what type of city it is to visit, but also the dichotomy that it presented from the Beijing part of China, and the idea that is essentially gone is depressing. But what may be even more depressing is that the United States' ability to do anything about it equally gone. And I think that was their view, is that we missed our opportunity, that that will no longer hold the place that it once held, and that we ought to learn as much as we can from the mishandling of the Hong Kong situation and make sure that we don't make similar mistakes when it comes to Taiwan or anywhere else.
I mean, the entire idea of how to deter Taiwan, though, still seems to me, you know, it was welcome that the administration sent Alex Azar, the HHS secretary, to Taiwan, senior-most American to visit Taipei in a long time, certainly drawing the ire of China. Mainland China did sort of step up its sort of military aggression that it's been recently exhibiting with greater consistency toward Taiwan. Did you see enough there from the standpoint of, you're a former retired Navy commander, public affairs officer, and certainly you have worked with senior leaders who are looking at this question of deterring Taiwan or certainly coping with the China challenge? Was there enough there from your standpoint that you feel is sufficient to deter China?
No, I worry about that quite a bit. I mean, I worry about our ability to deter, and I worry about if we fail in that deterrence. I worry about the willingness of the American people to actually follow the law and follow our commitments and actually defend Taiwan. I mean, I very much worry about that because of the time that I spent working with senior leaders who were very much focused on this challenge. And I worry about that because not because of where we are necessarily just today. I think what both General Gregson and Dr. Auslan made clear is that the position we find ourselves in, began several administrations ago. So I really hope that as a way of deterring any potential action against Taiwan, and as a way of competing with China longer term, I hope that those who will serve in positions of national security authority will really look closely at what we did right, and more importantly, what we did wrong vis-a-vis Hong Kong, and draw the appropriate lessons so that we don't make those same mistakes with Taiwan. So if we think that we have been doing it right, or if we think that continuing to do it the way we've been doing it will work with Taiwan, I think we're on the wrong path. And I more than I think that, I think that's what we heard from General Gregson and Dr. Auslan, was that competing is not enough. We are now in a point where we have to actively deter what a lot of people view as the next logical step for China, and that is to continue to pressure Taiwan.
Well, right. I mean, you know, the most important thing to do with an adversary is listen to their priorities and goals, because I think the Chinese have been remarkably consistent in that. I think there's a bipartisan recognition that as important as engagement is, and I think that that's what Misha was talking about, hundreds of thousands of Chinese, you know, millions of Chinese have studied in the United States over the past several decades. It hasn't really indicated that there's been a massive political shift in certainly how the Chinese administration or the Chinese Communist Party, right? I mean, it hasn't developed a more benevolent streak, a more democratic streak. If anything, it's shifted to a more authoritarian stance, a more centralized stance. Obviously, there is a lot of debate about whether or not that's over the long term going to be good for China or not. I think that there's a sense that it's maybe not going to be, because of the increasingly communist tendencies of the government, is interfering with the commercial elements of the country's industry, whether it was WeChat or TikTok or, you know, Huawei or Baidu or any of these companies that were looking to expand into the West as commercial firms, or ZTE has found themselves blunted, right? So, I mean, you could argue that it's already paying penalties for that, in part because the administration's tough stance. Let's shift to space. It was an interesting conversation with Todd Harrison and my good old friend Pete Garretson, retired United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, who's really been a leading space power strategist, and he's at the American Foreign Policy Council. Ilan Berman, Dr. Berman, is also one of our frequent guests on our Thursday roundtable. And I thought that was a fascinating conversation in the Space Force's new capstone document, how to think about not just the competition in space. I know that there has been a lot of concern among some, especially in the arms controlled community, not to militarize space, not recognizing that actually space has been militarized since the very start of the theater, when it was a V2 rocket that went through space on its way. Well, it might have been on a test flight, but I think ultimately, you know, they did cross through space on their way to landing on the United Kingdom during World War II. What were some of the takeaways from that? Because space is one of these theaters where sort of the more you understand, the more fascinating it is, especially in sort of defining what the area of responsibility is, the AOR. And when Pete said, well, it has to extend to the moon and beyond, right? I mean, this is kind of a big theater. And that's a real big geographic piece of terrain, I think, ultimately. And he made certainly, it was a thoughtful case, although I think some may disagree with it, and the need to militarize it as much as it was. It's being, what were your takeaways from that?
So I think the biggest takeaway for me as somebody that is not an expert on space or has not worked in jobs where my bosses were the experts on space, the complexity of the AOR, it's interesting to think about space as an AOR. You know, we thought Indo-PACOM was big. Boy, when we're talking about from Earth to the moon and beyond, I mean, that really gives you a sense of what a big AOR is. But the complexity of the AOR, the complexity of the domain, and then also the amount of different issues that experts and national security thinkers are trying to get their arms around is every time we talk to Todd and we talk to others that come on, that's what I'm left with. I mean, the issues that the space industrial base is dealing with, not just in terms of, you know, milestone issues or kind of what I would consider traditional space issues, which is, you know, meeting the next mark, you know, as we saw with the SpaceX rocket and as Boeing will work through here in the next year. I mean, but just kind of where they need to be, the types of things that they're going to do. You know, a lot of the same questions that we face in other domains is the industrial base healthy enough to achieve the things that we want as a country? Interagency dealings with space, you know, whether how will Space Force deal with NASA? How will it deal with other agencies that are launching or looking to space? And then you have sort of the most obvious one and from a military standpoint, and that's the stand-up of the Space Force and how will that go? Everything from, you know, what are you going to call people in the Space Force to how should you think about space in comparison to other domains? So it really is that complexity. And I thought both of the folks that you had on did a good job of not only hitting the individual issues of the day, but really leaving the listener with, boy, we've got a lot to think about and a lot to work through as we focus on space as a domain and as an AOR.
It was interesting that Pete brought up the as he viewed it, the imperative of having space ranks for right. the Space Force, which is a bone of some contention, obviously,
right.
Within. But I mean, other departments do it as well, right? I mean, the Department of the Navy has naval ranks for the Navy, but you know, general officer ranks in the Marine Corps. So I suppose, you can have an anchor on your uniform and be called a general, just like you can be an anchor, an admiral, and maybe have the Space Force triangle on it. Great logo, I have to say, and a great motto.
And if I will tell you, if I was a Space Force person, that is not the issue that I would be worried about. You know, when we talk about that complexity, I mean, I understand it's important.
You don't want to be called a space cadet as a former midshipman. You don't want to be called a space cadet or a spaceman.
I'll tell you what, I felt like a space cadet when I tried to wrap my mind around all of these complex issues. So, I mean, it does seem very pedestrian to be arguing and worrying about what we're going to call people in the Space Force. Boy, there are a lot bigger problems. So hopefully either they table this issue for a little while or they make a quick decision and start thinking about different domains, different AORs, I mean, and start working through some of the harder problems that they're going to have to deal with well into the future.
It was a great and vigorous roundtable conversation. A little bit of disagreement between Doctors Dove Zackheim, a proud conservative Republican who served in administrations of Ronald Reagan on through to George W. Bush, who's now with the CSIS think tank and former Pentagon comptroller, was his last senior job. Gordon Adams, originally a Californian for Richard Nixon, but I think the last five decades has been as a stalwart Democratic thinker. Who last served in the Clinton administration at the Office of Management and Budget. On the one hand, sort of making a case that DOD maybe didn't really need that $11 billion that Al Schaefer so articulated was needed. Byron Callen of Capital Alpha Partners and Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute on the other side sort of saying, hey, look, you know, if Congress doesn't make this money available in a new stimulus package, and I can sort of see their point, right? I mean, if your stimulus package is going to be $1 trillion or more dollars, surely you can put $11 billion into the package to cover what are justifiably allowable costs, right? I mean, at the end of the day, I don't think Lockheed Martin, Boeing, the Air Force, or the Navy, Marine Corps, or Army recognized that we would be in the midst of a coronavirus pandemic that would add to costs, both from a personnel safety standpoint. On the other hand, folks aren't traveling as much, and there are savings, obviously, that can be reaped there. What did you think were sort of the interesting takeaways from that discussion?
I focus more on what Mackenzie and Byron talked about. And in what struck me was this, the fragility of the industrial base. And so I think about, you know, we're 6 months into a pandemic and, in terms of numbers of people that have been affected and certainly the death toll and what it's done to the economy. It had a great impact across society, but I guess I just wonder, like, if it is having the degree of impact that it appears to be having in shipyards and in aircraft manufacturing facilities, that it requires an immediate $11 billion. Inject of revenue, and that's to say nothing of the early contracts that were let, and all of the other work that the acquisition professionals led by Ellen Lord and her team have done. it makes me wonder what we would, how we would handle conflict or high-end competition. You know, if you're worried about losing nuclear welders, and if you're worried about shipyards having to close because they don't have enough people because of the effects of the pandemic, how are you ever going to add 2 and 3 extra shifts should we need to rapidly produce armaments, or should we need to rapidly produce ships and aircraft should there be a conflict on a large scale? So I thought the point that Dove and Gordon made in terms of, hey, they should have been able to, they being DOD, should have been able to handle this within the, you know, mid $700 billion budget that they have. They shouldn't have needed Congress to act. They should have been able to either be ahead of the bow wave, or certainly riding that bow wave instead of kind of reacting after it crashes. But I think that's an important point. But at the same time, I can't help but think that, wow, I mean, this is a real test of that industrial base. And again, I mean, I guess my word of the podcast is lessons learned. There are a lot of lessons learned here that I hope both DOD and industry recognize as we look at what potential competition might be like. Should it go high-end cold, or, you know, God forbid, hot sometime in the future?
It reminds me of a question that we were asking at the very beginning of this pandemic of every single person, and we've tried to sort of maintain that questioning, right, of how is this experience preparing you for the next big crisis? And what's encouraging is whether that's Hondo Gertz or Will Roper or Ellen Lord or Al Schaefer or Jim Faist or Mark Lewis, there is a focus on how do we step up and improve our game. And there, I thought Al was very thoughtful, as somebody who'd spent a full career in uniform, retiring as a colonel, and then being on the research and development side of the Pentagon, and now on the acquisition and sustainment side, of the focus that he was bringing to, you know, accelerating the development of capability, trying to do it more thoughtfully, and while at the same time sort of overseeing, given that most of the responsibility resides in each of the military services. But what I still think is startling, and I think that the American people have become numb to, is yesterday, I think 1,500 Americans died, right? And I think that there's this tendency of not, of thinking like, hey, we're frustrated and we're stuck at home and we don't have that many places to go, or I'm yearning to get out. And you realize, as we've heard from Dr. Redfield, we've heard from Dr. Fauci, we've heard from Dr. Birx and others, that the virus in many respects is completely out of control now. So it's going to take the course that it takes and make things a lot tougher for everybody in the fall, which to me is rather extraordinary, right? You and I were talking, and 350 people dying brought Boeing to its knees, and yet three times that number are dying every day. It seems not to have galvanized the kind of focus I think we all, you know what I mean? I mean, there's almost it is what it is, and, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to live my life, not fully understanding that you may be asymptomatic, right? A quarter of people are asymptomatic. You may cause somebody else to be infected, and everybody's putting their hope on a vaccine, and everybody wants that vaccine to happen. But the notion that it's somehow going to be an overnight light switch flips, and it's kind of interesting.
As a communicator, that challenge resonates with me, because I think in any other catastrophe or crisis, it has been a lot easier to show what the suffering or the result of that catastrophe looks like. I mean, you mentioned aircraft crashes. I mean, if it's a crash, you're able to show debris and jet fuel burning and people crying. And I mean, so there really is an image of what that suffering looks like. But because of the precautions that we've taken with the pandemic, really the imagery of this has largely been of politicians either talking about it or, you know, preparing for it or passing legislation or in many cases not passing legislation. You know, I don't know that it's really been burned in the minds of the American people. And so their version of what this looks and feels like is colored by their day-to-day experience. And I think that sadly, until it gets bad enough that you have that burning in to a large enough group's mind, or you have a massive change in national leadership, I think we're kind of rudderless, just kind of going along, as you said, headed towards a worse fall.
I know that ordinarily, you know, we like to talk about national security on the program. Obviously, the choice of Kamala Harris is historic on many counts. We did talk about this on the roundtable a little bit. From a national security implication, what message do you take away? The second question is, what does it tell you about Joe Biden and how Joe Biden will make decisions or makes decisions?
I think Mackenzie did a good job of pointing out and kind of using the lens of the committee assignments that Senator Harris has had and her performance in the Senate. In those committees as a way of looking at, you know, how she might handle national security. And I think from a, you know, from a traditionalist like I am as a retired naval officer, I would say that I feel pretty good about her national security pedigree and her national security decision making. I mean, you know, that now she'll have her political and ideological bent on that. But I mean, if you look at how she's performed, I feel safe, I would say. And I think that, you know, as you look at Vice President Biden's decision-making, I think one, I mean, he made it very clear early on that he wanted to pick a woman to be his running mate. And so the pool kind of shrunk to account for that. And then the front runners within that smaller pool tended to kind of have many different characteristics. I mean, I think he picked someone that has a varied experience. I think he picked someone that will be safe, as I mentioned, with, you know, on national security decisions and will help him make those decisions. But probably most importantly, he picked someone that is significantly younger than he is. And you have to account for his age, and you want the vice president, who is a heartbeat away from the presidency, to be able to step in should the president need that. So I guess as I try to look at all of this and forecast how his decision making will be should he be president, I think it's very pragmatic. He seemed to check all of the boxes that you would want somebody running for office to check. And I think they will be a formidable team as we move forward into the rest of the campaigning season. I will say that I think none of that campaigning will matter, as we've talked about. I mean, I think most people have made up their mind either way, and it'll come down to turnout. But I think if you're a Joe Biden fan, I think you like this pick. I think if you're a Trump fan, I think you don't like this pick, and it didn't matter. But for the Biden camp, I think they feel pretty good about it.
There is, however, a criticism, right, that, you know, Senator Biden, who has spent a lifetime in public service, you know, I mean, critics would say that occasionally he's made, you know, bad decisions or been on the wrong side of decisions. On the other hand, there are those who say that, you know, he's somebody who does learn from the bad decisions and actually tries to make better decisions the next time. And certainly anybody who's been involved in politics as long as he has successfully been able to portray himself as different things to different. The Economist had an interesting story about, you know, I'm not as liberal as people think I am. I think early on he, you know, in his during his first election, where he sort of gave a nod to protesters while at the same time appealing to older voters who are a little bit worried about, you know, the protests on the street during the Nixon era. Well, let me ask you a military voting question, right? I mean, sure. The president, you know, the one thing about the president you can count on is that he eventually comes flat out and says the things that people right. say he's doing, right? I mean, you got to hand it to him.
For as much criticism as he gets for lying or bending the truth, actually, if you listen to what he says, he kind of reveals himself pretty well. But
correct. I mean, he lies about. I mean, the prolific nature of his lying is can only fill you with a degree of admiration, I suppose. But I mean, the thing about it is, he also lays it out, right? I'm not going to fund voting because the voting will depend on the election. Subclause, I'm getting my butt whooped. It's going to be a lot worse if these people vote. Ergo, I have to suppress the vote. I mean, it's very clear. And if Democrats want that, I'm going to extort them somehow for that amount of money that they need, whether it's the $3.5 billion to cover added state costs, or if it's the $25 billion or so, in part because of the stupidity of the law on how the Postal Service does, you know, manages its retirement accounts. How does this affect military voting? Because military members, a gigantic portion of them, many of them, right, have Florida residency, for example. I'm not busting on Florida, but military people buy there because there are no taxes, right? So people rotate on assignment through there if they're Navy or Air Force, and they buy a house in Florida, and that becomes their residence so that they live tax-free, even if their duty station is in Virginia or, you know, any one of them, you know, Washington, D.C. or anywhere else. How does this affect military members and how they're going to vote?
I'll give you the glass half empty, glass half full. Glass half full first. I mean, I think a lot of military members have maybe more experience than the general population in terms of voting absentee. So, I mean, in my own case, I mean, I've voted from Italy, where I, you know, got my ballot several weeks in advance. I filled out my ballot, I mailed it in, and presumably it was counted, you know, as part of the regular process. I voted absentee where I went early to the, you know, Board of Elections in beautiful Leonardtown, Maryland, and voted in the elections, and, you know, dropped it in a voting case. And again, presumably it was counted several weeks later on the day of the election. So I think for folks in the military, there is that experience. And so if the decision is made to vote via mail or to offer the ability to vote early, where you can go in early, fill out your ballot so that you don't have the long lines and some of the concerns that would butt up against social distancing. I think folks in the military can wrap their mind around that maybe a lot easier. On the glass half empty side, there was always that question of whether or not your vote would be counted, because did it matter, right? I mean, because the people that voted on election day, especially as we got into the digital age, if the numbers were so large, or if the difference between candidates was so large, your vote, there was a sense that maybe your vote didn't count or wasn't going to be hand counted, because it really didn't matter. So I think the military experience is mixed in how we will go forward. I mean, either way, people should vote, whether it's by mail or whether it's in person early or whether it's standing in a socially distant line on, you know, the first Tuesday in November.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting, right? But I mean, I think people have a tendency of forgetting that the military postal system only brings you so far, and then that just plugs into the rest of the postal system. So it either goes on a, you know, USPS is the one that ships it, whether it's going on an Amtrak train or whether it's in a truck or whether it's on an airplane. And as we break for the week, what are the things you're going to be paying attention to next week?
Well, I'm a political junkie, regardless of what side of the aisle. I am interested to see what a socially distant Democratic National Convention looks and feels like. I'm interested in hearing what the acolytes of the Democratic Party say and how they say it and how it's presented. Again, while I don't know that next week or the week after for the Republicans will really matter with the electorate, I am interested to hear from the leaders in each party. And I'm fearful that we will not hear much on national security, but I'm looking to see what we do hear and to see what will stick as the two parties work through the next 2 weeks.
Well, we're looking forward to trying to give as thoughtful analysis of that as possible. And also on Monday, we're going to be joined by retired United States Marine Corps General and former National Security Advisor Jim Jones, Barry Pavel of the Atlantic Council think tank, and Bat Sparrow, the University of Texas at Austin, professor who wrote the extraordinary biography of General Brent Scowcroft, called The Strategist, Remembrance of General Scowcroft and What He's Meant to the National Security Community, and indeed to the nation, as somebody who devoted his entire life to military and to national service in one form or another. So I think that's going to be a very special and highlighted show. Chris, thanks very much for joining us. Have a great weekend, and look forward to having you back on next week.
You too. Thank you very much.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.